The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show here on KPCG. This is Richard Palmer standing in for Mr. Stephen Flurry, who's visiting the Netherlands right now. I'd like to start out with a couple of news items that lead into a really astonishing and dangerous story that I'd like to talk to you about. But to kind of move into that general subject, I'll read a couple of news news items on this general subject. The first is from Foreign Policy, published on Monday, and it's called No Country for Old Generals. It makes a short but very interesting point. It begins by writing, the post-9/11 wars haven't produced many war heroes, and that's bad news for Republicans hoping a retired general can save them this fall. And it talks about how Republicans who aren't really big fans of Cruz or Trump, they've been searching around for a war hero to lead them. They talk about the attractions of a retired general as a presidential candidate. But the trouble is, they can't find anyone. The article continues. Actually, they quote Peter Fever, who's a professor of political science at Duke University, who says, it takes a certain kind of war to make a general a president. You've got to have a decisive victory. The problem is, America hasn't had one of those for years. And so, without the decisive victory, there's no general there who they could look to, who they could put as up forward as a presidential candidate. Now, there's a couple of things that this article reminds me, and I'm sure many of our regular listeners of. One was that Mr. Armstrong said right back in the 60s and even the 50s that America had won its last war. We have a free booklet called He Was Right, and that's the title of one of those chapters, America Has Won Its Last War. And we see that again and again. America lacks military success, as this Foreign Policy article brings out. Another thing this article brings quickly to mind is a verse in Isaiah 3 where God says he has taken away the mighty man and the man of war. And that's exactly what we see now, the people looking for a man of war, looking for a successful general to lead the country, and they can't find one. The second article I'd like to talk about briefly, just to introduce our main topic today, is one published on April 12th by Real Clear Defense, and it's called Russia and China Increase Defense While US Cuts. And they begin by writing, every year at this time we see the same kind of headlines. US biggest military spender in the world. They're all based on the release of the Global Military Spending Database, an annual report compiled by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI. What the headlines usually miss is that the US defense spending is going down while global military spending is going up. The fact that the US spends more on defense than any other individual nation dramatically misses the point. It goes on to talk about how America is facing more and more threats, that more and more nations are becoming hostile to the United States. It talks about the threat posed by Russia, by China, by North Korea. And it goes on to write, the US military budget has been cut by 25%. Within the last 5 years. This has resulted in dramatic declines in the US military's ability to fight and win, as we read about in the Foreign Policy article. 15 years of conflict and years of tight budgets have taken a grave toll, worsened by these budget cuts. Top military leaders have told Congress that their readiness is, as the Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force recently put it, at a near all-time low, due to continuous combat operations, reduced manpower, an aging fleet, and inconsistent funding. And they write, third, a big part of why the US maintains a large military is because we have learned that major conflict in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia can be devastating to our economy. A strong US military can help deter conflicts in these regions and, if deterrence fails, win a conflict quickly, thus mitigating a war's effect on the US. The article goes on to point out that from 2011 to 2015, US defense spending fell by 21%, while Russia and China's both rose by around 40%. And so these points that this article bring out You know, those are things that Mr. Flurry spoke about earlier this week on Monday and Tuesday. And in a lot of ways, today's program could almost be considered a part two to what Mr. Flurry spoke about on Tuesday. If you heard that program, he talked about the dire state of so many parts of America's military. He discussed the dreadful shortage of planes in the U.S. Marine Corps, for example, about how cutbacks were forcing major decreases in the power and in the capacity of the U.S. military. He talked about the major problems caused by all the setbacks by the hugely expensive F-35 program. And today I'd like to talk about something else that's a real worry for America's military, and that is how military spending is wasted. I don't think anyone is really ignorant that the US military wastes a lot of money, but I think you'll be shocked, I certainly was, by the scale of some of the things that we're going to be talking about today. It is really on an unbelievable scale. And it's useful to talk about this when the military figure spendings are out, like Real Clear Defense spoke about or wrote about, where you see headlines talking about how the U.S. spends more than its military on, just off the top of my head, I think it was somewhere around the next nine nations combined. But Britain, about America, you know, we're great at throwing money at problems. We throw tons of money at education, for example, only to be thoroughly thrashed by a whole bunch of other countries in the league tables. Looking at what is spent doesn't tell us anything about how it is spent. But there's something even more important to consider than just the vast amount of money that's wasted, and that is what this wastage says about the basic competence of those running the US military, about how focused they are on defending America, or whether their priorities are elsewhere. And as you'll see by the end of the program, their priorities are indeed very much on other things. But I want to begin this subject by introducing you to Fat Leonard. Fat Leonard robbed, as he's commonly known, he robbed tens of millions of dollars from the U.S. Navy. If this was a bank heist, that would be major news. It has made a few headlines, but it's a major scandal right at the top of the Navy that's not received a huge amount of attention. But the scale of what happened there, the fact that this was going on, it raises some major, major questions. And so to bring you up to speed on the Fat Leonard scandal, here are some excerpts from a PBS NewsHour report when the scandal was first unearthed back in the autumn of 2013.
It could be the biggest fraud scandal to hit the Navy in years, involving allegations that top commanders received cash, prostitutes, and other favors for inflated contracts that cost the Pentagon hundreds of millions of dollars. Jeffrey Brown has the story.
For decades, Leonard Francis, known as Fat Leonard for his imposing girth, has been well connected in top U.S. Navy circles, perhaps too connected. His company, Glen Defense Marine, provided logistics support for U.S. warships at ports in East Asia. Since 2011, the company has won more than $200 million in Navy contracts. Contracts that federal investigators now charge are at the center of an elaborate criminal conspiracy involving bribery, fraud, and more. Last month, the Washington Post reported that Francis plied top Navy commanders with prostitutes, cash, luxury hotel rooms, even tickets to a Lady Gaga concert in Thailand. In return, officials at the Justice Department say Francis received classified information on ship deployments. He also allegedly pressured commanders to steer ships to ports where his company would then overcharge for services like sewage disposal and tugboats. In September, the Justice Department arrested Francis and two Navy commanders, as well as a top agent in the Naval Criminal Investigative Service who allegedly fed him information. Two admirals, including the Director of Naval Intelligence, have been placed on leave and lost their security clearances.
Now, firstly, imposing girth has got to be the most polite way of calling somebody fat that I have ever heard. But far more importantly, that gives you a pretty good summary of the facts of the case. Fat Leonard's company did what was called husbanding for ships. So when they come into port, there's all kinds of services they need. They need to have their sewage emptying. They need to refuel. They need to restock with food. They need other supplies. They may need tugboats to get them into the port. They'll need to pay for parking. They'll often need minor repairs. And Leonard's company ripped the Navy off in a huge way. And he barely tried to hide the cheating in one extended trip to Thailand. He overbilled the Navy for fuel to the tune of $1.3 million. That's just overbilling on fuel, one trip to Thailand. I could easily spend the rest of this program talking about the brazen and outrageous ways he swindled the Navy. He was a contractor. This company was a contractor for the Navy for 20 years. So how on earth did he get away with this? Well, he had major ties to people right at the top of the Navy's 7th Fleet, and that's, I believe that's the world's largest fleet, the largest military fleet at least. And, you know, these ties ran so deep that in the last couple of years, and since that news report was written, more and more has been coming out about this, to the ties to people at the top of the Navy. At least five, and I think it may even be up to six admirals now, have got into trouble over this. They've not been charged. But for example, in February 2015, Navy Secretary Ray Mabuse censored three rear admirals to do with this scandal. The chief of Navy intelligence is under investigation about that he may have been connected to this in his previous job. He's had his security clearance revoked. So obviously, if the head of Navy intelligence is no longer allowed to read secret papers, that's a bit of a problem. Now, in terms of the nuts and bolts, Leonard Francis, he bribed the commander of a destroyer and the deputy logistics officer for the whole 7th Fleet. They gave him classified information on the ship movements so that he could be best placed to rip the Navy off. They even rerouted his ship so that they'd sail close. They rerouted U.S. Navy ships so that they'd sail close to and stop at ports owned by Leonard Francis. Another significant person on his payroll was a supervisory agent at the Navy Criminal Investigative Service. And he was vital in making sure Leonard wasn't caught for years, because obviously he was in charge of investigating and finding out these type of crimes. And so he made sure that that Leonard was warned well in advance and that all of this was covered up. And that's how he stole tens of millions of US dollars from the taxpayer, from the Defense Department. And more than the money stolen, does that fill you with confidence in the US Navy? That the people commanding the ships, even in charge of routing multiple ships, can be bought like that? You know, what if this was a foreign power? What if that had been a foreign power behind this? And what does this say about the Navy, how the Navy controls its spending overall, that this could go on for so long? The PBS NewsHour segment we played earlier, they went on to interview Craig Whitlock, who he helped break the story to the public in the Washington Post. I think it was in September 2013. And here's a short section from that interview.
I guess another big question is whether this is a very specific type of example, bad example, or does it signify some larger systemic problem that the Navy or perhaps other rest of military has?
Well, I think the military in general does have a problem. We see this kind of case come up not infrequently, where contract fraud, people overcharge the government. It's a very chummy business with retired Navy or military officers. Leonard had retired Navy officers on his payroll. And so I don't think this is an isolated case. And I think we may see some more investigations in this kind of business with the Navy, not just his company, but others as well.
So this type of thing, it's not unusual. And here's what Matthew Gault wrote for the defense blog War is Boring, again, back in the autumn of 2013. The Fat Leonard affair is just the latest corruption case to come out of the U.S. military, an organization that has seen more than its share of scandals in the past decade. For generations, the Pentagon has run the world's mightiest armed forces with inadequate budgetary oversight. The system is broken. Something needs to change, and it needs to change yesterday. If it doesn't, the Fat Leonard debacle, with its self-serving commanders, misspent millions, and compromised military secrets, could become the norm. That's what we're looking at here. It needs fixing yesterday. Of course, we're about, what, two and a half years down the line? It's not been fixed. And this is just the biggest of many examples. The U.S. government recently investigated three Navy intelligence officers who worked together to charge $1.6 million for silencers that should have cost $8,000. There was the case of two twin sisters who ran a company that collected $20 million, largely by fraud and abusing the system. In one case, they charged $500,000 to ship 3 screws to Marines in Iraq. I mean, you might think shipping is bad somewhere on eBay, but $500,000 for shipping. Just over 15 years ago, there was another very significant case. An Air Force undersecretary was charged with corruption. She paid on behalf of the Defense Department, on behalf of taxpayers ultimately, $8.5 billion, more than was necessary for a set of planes from Boeing. And that's billion, not million. And at the same time that she negotiated that deal, she was negotiating a job with Boeing. She gave them those few extra billion, then she quit her job and went to work for Boeing with a 6-figure salary. And Boeing had already given jobs to her daughter and her fiance, or her daughter's fiance. So this isn't, and in this case, you know, that's not a dodgy guy ripping the Navy off billions. This is Boeing. This is one of the world's biggest defense companies, one of the world's largest best-known airplane manufacturers, that in this case is accused of deliberately ripping off the US government to the tune of billions. And this is something that might be becoming, there's some evidence it's becoming more and more common. The LA Times, they had an article in 2014 looking at cases of misconduct among senior army officers. And they were talking about how there was a huge jump from 2011 on in up and then on to 2012, 2013. After 2011, a huge jump. And when looking at this misconduct among senior military officials, they wrote, the review found that most of the major cases of alleged misconduct involved generals and admirals failing to abide by ethics rules governing gifts, travel, and use of official funds. And they wrote, senior commanders have long enjoyed perks, including nice houses and large staffs. But in the last decade, as the Pentagon budget expanded, many grew accustomed to ever more lavish benefits, including aircraft at their disposal, large entourages, and treatment befitting heads of state when they traveled abroad, some officers conceded. So when you start to look at corruption in the military, you have contractors stealing money, generals living the high life, and it's on the increase. More and more examples of senior military officials being caught up in this. Now, there are faults with these companies and that are ripping the government off, but there are some major faults with the whole purchase system. You know, I'm sure none of us have ever paid $500,000 for shipping. You know, no one forces you to do that. Things are badly wrong here. And that's where we're going to look at next. After the break, we're going to move on a bit from corruption and talk about government waste. So stick around for some truly eye-watering numbers.
The Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The idea of wasteful spending by the military has been a national punchline since the days of crazily expensive screwdrivers and toilet seats. But the war in Afghanistan in particular has been this never-ending font of ever more astonishing stories about stuff that we, the U.S. taxpayers, have built, that we physically created or bought or arranged to be procured for this war, that are absolutely unneeded, that are in some cases worse than wasteful. It was, for instance, the incredible melting Afghan police training center that we spent $500,000 for. It melts when it rains. Then there's a fleet of airplanes that we bought for Afghanistan for $486 million and then ended up shredding into scrap for 6 cents a pound. That's a loss of 99.93% on that investment. And there were the giant incinerators we installed at a U.S. base for $5 million that have never incinerated anything because they never worked. So the base just torched all its waste in an open-air burn pit next to the incinerators. But one of the most expensive of all of these, and one of the most astonishing of all of these, was this Marine headquarters in Helmand Province. It's larger than a football field. It has elaborate state-of-the-art workspaces for 1,500 people. It has a state-of-the-art briefing theater and a military operations center that includes stadium-style tiered seating. It cost $36 million to build, and it has never, not once, been used. Look, you can see the plastic wrap is still on the chairs. Now, what sets this boondoggle apart, what was particularly inexplicable about it, was that the military said no to building it repeatedly. Not one, not two, but three generals on the ground requested that the project be canceled before construction had even begun. They said, please, don't build this. We don't need it. And by the time it's finished, we'll be drawing down from Afghanistan anyway. And it's made worse by the fact that the military, when they realized the special inspector general was likely to start sniffing around this giant, fully furnished, multi-million-dollar headquarters that had never been used, the military did its own internal report that determined that everything was fine, that there was nothing wrong with this process. No one did anything wrong. And when the special inspector general did indeed start poking around, the legal advisor to the commander of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan encouraged officials to slow roll the requests for information.
That was a couple of clips from the Rachel Meadows Show on MSNBC. Welcome back to KPCG here on 101.3 on the FM dial if you're listening in Edmond, Oklahoma. Available online at kpcg.fm. On Tuesday, Mr. Stephen Flurry talked about how desperate some parts of the military are for money, on the real hardship that they're facing and how America is being put at risk. Today, we're following that up by looking at how the US is wasting money, money that is desperately needed elsewhere. This is also something that Mr. Andrew Locher spoke about on Trumpet Hour a few weeks back. He has an article up on our website, thetrumpet.com, called Another Defeat for America's Military. When I heard that he was going to talk about this, I was a little bit worried. I've been collecting material on this subject for a couple of years now. And then I was looked like right at the end, somebody was going to come in and pinch this subject from me. But there's so much material here. There is easily plenty left to fill up a program. In fact, I could quite comfortably talk for several programs on this subject, just on military waste. We spent the first segment looking at some pretty horrific examples of corruption within the military. Now we're moving on to look at wasted spending, and there is no better place to start than Afghanistan and Iraq. These were hugely expensive endeavors. I think by some estimates, the US spent around $1 trillion on the war in Afghanistan. They've spent over $100 billion on reconstruction efforts. To put that in perspective, most of you probably know the US had a huge program to rebuild Europe after World War II called the Marshall Plan. The US has spent more on Afghanistan reconstruction than the entire Marshall Plan, and that's even adjusted for inflation. One figure that really drove home to me the vast scales of money that we're talking about here in the Middle East is that a few years ago, the US was spending $20 billion $1,000 a year on air conditioning in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are a lot of countries whose entire economic output does not come to $20 billion. You know, if you were to take the entire economic output of Iceland or Malta or Malawi, that you could not afford using that to pay the American military's air conditioning bill in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, to put it another way, that's about the same as Italy's entire military budget just on air conditioning. Now, I'm not saying that that's wasted, but it gives an idea of the scale of money that we're talking about that America was spending in these countries. Of course, now that given that Afghanistan is sliding back towards the Taliban and that Iraq is being taken over by Iran, there is a very strong case that everything that was spent in these two countries has been a waste of money. But today I just want to focus on just the very obvious and immediate waste spending within the US military. Now, one more note on these numbers before we bring up a few more. You know, we're talking about millions, billions, in some cases even trillions. You know, they're so big that it's hard to get a handle on. So let's kind of put this in terms of money that we're used to. The US military budget is in the ballpark of $800 billion a year. So when we're talking about the military wasting tens of millions, that would be roughly equivalent to you or I wasting maybe $3 or $4. You know, it takes up about the same proportion of the defense budget as a Starbucks coffee may take up of your salary. So that doesn't sound like very much, but as I'm sure you know, a trip to Starbucks compared to your salary is pretty cheap. Do it every day, and it adds up pretty fast. And it's the same for the military. You know, they waste a few tens of millions here, there, everywhere, and it really adds up. But when we're talking about wasting billions, that's more seriously. You know, when the military wastes tens of billions, that's roughly the equivalent of us wasting $1,000 or so, or in the thousands of our annual income. And that's a pretty big deal. I'm sure if you lost $3,000 or $4,000 tomorrow, you would be pretty upset about that. Now, we heard about some of the waste in that clip at the top of the program. The US labeled $11 billion as wasted in Afghanistan in just 1 year. So again, that's billion. That's a little bit less than Canada's entire defense budget. Now, as I said, we heard about some of the worst examples in Afghanistan at the top of the clip. That $36 million for a command facility that's never been used. And then not only that, when investigators started hunting around saying, you know, how did this happen? How can we stop this colossal waste of money happening again? The US military blocked them. It refused to cooperate, tried to slow the investigation down. It appears they're more interested in protecting their people than they were in making sure that taxpayers' money went to where it was vitally needed. Now, the person responsible for looking into a lot of this waste and for exposing a lot of this waste is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or the SIGAR. His name is John F. Sopko. He gave a talk last September at the Georgetown University in which he talked about the obstacles that he faced, the money that was wasted, the mentality of the people spending that money. One of the things he talked about was something called the Commander's Emergency Response Program, or SERP, and we'll hear him talk about that in just a minute. And SERP was designed for commanders to use to help build things for the Afghan people. But the problem was it was badly overseen. It didn't have clear goals or guidelines for the spending. Nobody really looked into how effective the things that were being built by SERP would be in the long term. And so here's what Sopko said about this multi-billion dollar SERP program in that speech.
Therefore, it should not surprise anyone that the sustainability of SERP-funded schools have been singled out by my agency and other oversight bodies because they're literally crumbling and falling apart. Or that SERP-funded hospitals actually have become unsafe because their electrical, water, and other systems fail.
So all that money that went into building those schools, those hospitals, wasted. A bit later in that speech, he talked about another major reason that so much money was wasted in Afghanistan. You know, the US built expensive high-tech facilities that would have been great in a modern American city, but the locals just couldn't afford, and or in other cases didn't have the resources to maintain them. And so Sopko talked about a hospital in Gardez that the US built, and that's a capital of an Afghan province. And on the surface, it looked great. It was 12 times bigger than the previous hospital. This one didn't melt in the rain or catch fire or anything. But it was 5 times more expensive to operate than the usual Afghan hospitals. And this kind of thing is causing the Afghanistan government serious, serious problems. Well, so many of these things that America built in Afghanistan are getting abandoned or just broken down because the locals can't use them. The hospital is just one out of many, as Sopko explains in just a moment. It's a, I think it's a 2 or 3 minute long clip, or it's a couple of different clips together. But you can hear how agitated he gets with the stupidity and the consistency of this kind of waste.
I wish I could say that what happened in Gardez is isolated, but this sort of thing, as the Minister of Education told me the same thing, and other ministers have told me, is a common occurrence in Afghanistan. You would have thought, after having worked in Iraq, after having worked in Haiti, and after having worked around the world in reconstruction efforts, way before I became the SIGAR, that we in the United States and the rest of the developing community would have been able to handle and foresee the problems when you over-donate, over-give, and don't consider sustainability when you do reconstruction. You would think at some point somebody in the administration would wake up and say, you know, folks, maybe we're going about this all wrong. It seems that time and time again, people have to be reminded in our administration, it's Afghanistan, it's not Kansas, it's not Norway, it's not Bethesda. I want to give people in the administration the benefit of the doubt on this kind of thing. Part of me is saying that perhaps these officials just want the Afghans to have high quality infrastructure. I try to remind myself of that when we build multi-billion dollar roads to U.S. and international weight standards in a country that has no ability to enforce weight limitations. Of course, the roads are crumbling. And of course, the Afghans don't have the funds and capabilities to maintain them. Or when a military official tells me of a brilliant idea to spend millions of dollars to build high-tech bus stops in Afghanistan, complete with solar-powered lighting, as if this were D.C. or Bethesda. Heck, I don't even have solar-powered lighting in my bus stop on River Road, but we're going to give it to the Afghans and assume they can maintain it. Again, I am hoping that people have the best intentions in the world. But if I am doing my job and being the good umpire that I was appointed by President Obama to be, all I am seeing is a modus operandi that is woefully out of touch with reality at best and delusional at worst. We simply must be smarter with our reconstruction and foreign assistance. We have to be, if our country is going to play its critical role building peace and stabilization in war-torn societies for years to come.
Listen to some of the things that he's saying there. We're going about this all wrong. Multi-billion dollar roads are crumbling. A delusional modus operandi. And as he points out, the US military has made these mistakes before. You know, they made them in Afghanistan. They went on to make exactly the same mistakes in Iraq. You have a military official wanting to build high-tech solar-powered bus stops in Afghanistan. You know, what does that tell you about the thinking of the military over there? Are they looking to maximize the military's scarce resources? And you know, how's that for a metaphor for the US in Afghanistan right now, talking about building high-tech bus stops while the Taliban retakes the country? And this wastage adds up to huge numbers. ProPublica put the price tag for waste and misguided expenditure in Afghanistan at $17 billion. And that includes things like this base that's never used, payments to non-existent soldiers, building roads that have fallen apart. There's the $500 million that we heard about at the clip at the start of this section on these aircraft that never flew and then were chopped up to scrap. And then there's the things that just didn't work. You know, the US spent $8 billion on fighting the drugs trade in Afghanistan. And during this time that they were spending all this money, Afghanistan's drug production went up. And they point out that their $17 billion figure comes from examining just a small percentage of the $110 billion spent on reconstruction. So the actual figure is likely much higher. But there are 80 nations in the world whose entire national output is less than $17 billion. Now that's about what Israel spends on its defense each year. You know, Israel has a pretty capable defense force. And what it spends to build and maintain that is the same as what America wastes in Afghanistan. And the numbers just go on and on. 230 million in spare parts to repair Afghan army vehicles. That's gone missing. 1.5 billion spent on materials to build things for the Afghan military. That's just on the material cost, not the wages, for example, of the US soldiers building them. 1.5 billion, but they used the wrong kind of insulation, and so these buildings all catch fire really easily. Another writer identified $33 billion of waste since Mr. Obama took office in just 27 outrageous incidents. And that brings us to another important point. You know, this isn't just an Afghanistan problem or an Iraq problem. It's endemic throughout the military. The Defense Logistics Agency, the DLA, they're responsible for buying a lot of different materials, stuff for the military. And they managed to buy $7 billion in stuff that they don't need. Politico had an article on this back in December, and they quoted Arnold Perino, who's a retired major general in the Marine Corps Reserve, who's currently overseeing a special task force on logistics for the Pentagon. And he said, "How do you buy $7 billion of stuff you don't need? If a company did that, they'd be out of business. Even Walmart." And the stories coming out of the DLA are pretty terrible. You know, for example, ordering parts and then throwing them straight in the bin. Or, you know, if you or I order something from Amazon and there's a mistake in the order, maybe there's a part missing, or maybe even there's a part or two extra, or simple missing paperwork, we're either going to make do, or we'll give Amazon a call, and you know, they're great at sending out a replacement. But not the DLA. You know, they'll just chuck the mistaken order in the bin. So in some cases, they've been found to do this, and then just order another one and pay for it again. The DLA manages $70 billion of ammunition, and it manages it horribly. Some ends up being sitting around for decades. Other times, the DLA blows up deliberately, not accidentally. That would be a even bigger problem, but deliberately blows up billions, again, billions, not millions, but billions of dollars of useful, usable ammunition. For example, in 2014, it got rid of over $1 billion in excess bullets. Now, what causes all of these huge problems? Well, Purano talked about it. That's the same person we quoted from the Politico article. He talked about it being a problem throughout the whole culture of the military. And he said, "It has no sense of value or time. No one in the Pentagon is looking for a bargain on most days. It's a cultural thing. There are people who will ship a pallet of water on a C-17 transport plane." And this is one important thing. And that's something we heard about in those clips from SOPCO earlier. We also talked about the corruption. And that's certainly a big problem and one that we dealt with earlier. Another problem is the military is just really bad at dealing with contractors. And you know, there's blame somewhere, but I don't want to necessarily heap all the blame on these big companies, though it does look like they deserve some. You know, they have some complaints of their own against the government. So I don't want to get exactly into who is to blame, but the way the US deals with outside companies clearly is not working. Here's a quote from the Project of Government on Government Oversight. They had an article where they wrote, "You buy a new car. Days later, you receive a notice from the manufacturer recalling the car due to a defect. It would be ridiculous to pay the manufacturer again to fix the defect, wouldn't it? That's basically what the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard are doing on shipbuilding contracts, according to a report released last week by the Government Accountability Office. And they quote this report, which says the Navy and Coast Guard paid the shipbuilder to build the ship as part of the construction contract, and then paid the same shipbuilder again to repair the ship when defects were discovered after delivery, essentially rewarding the shipbuilder for delivering a ship that needed additional work. And this is what Mr. Andrew Locust spoke about, and this type of thing going on for America's nuclear attack submarines. Now, in the case of these ships and the study by the Government Accountability Office, they looked at just 6 ships, and the taxpayer ended up paying $6.4 million to fix costs associated with contractors doing bad work. And that's on 6 ships. The U.S. has hundreds. And on this subject, David W. Rice wrote on War is Boring, "The Navy, like the other services, has proven itself incapable of running an effective weapons acquisition program in recent decades. Instead, the service pays increasingly more money for progressively fewer units that often fail to meet original specifications." And we see this throughout the military. Cost shooting up, performance is decreasing. We've kind of taken a zoomed-in look a bit on the F-35, that fighter jet before. The plane that is literally the future of the Air Force. They plan on having the bulk of their planes be F-35s. And that's a $1.5 trillion, not million, not billion, trillion project. The most expensive weapons program in history. And it's full of these kind of delays and cost overruns. The littoral combat ship, it's a similar, beset by similar problems. Those ships, these were meant to cost $220 million each. The first one cost 3 times that amount. The second one was 4 times that amount. They have universally bad reviews. In simulated battles, they consistently get sunk. So this inability to work with outside companies and make good deals is a big problem. Now, related to that, and this is a major problem here, is that far too many decisions regarding America's defense equipment are made not because of military necessity, but because of jobs in particular congressional districts. So, for example, take the M1 Abrams tank. The U.S. has 9,000 of these tanks, and half of them are in storage. So they're not really using them. Yet the military is building more, spending roughly in the region, I mean, it varies from year to year, but somewhere in the region of $200 million each year to keep building tanks that no one needs. Why? Because the factory that makes these tanks is in the congressional district of the chairman of the Tactical Air and Land Forces Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee. And this kind of thing is common. The New York Times in December, they wrote about a case where language inserted into the federal budget by Senator Thad Cochran, Republican of Mississippi, directed the Coast Guard to build a $640 million national security cutter in Mississippi that the Coast Guard says it does not need. If we are funded for it and Congress says you're going to have a 9th cutter, I guess that's how it goes, said Chief Warrant Officer Chad Saylor, a Coast Guard spokesman. Oh, they've managed to get a spokesman named Saylor. That's he's in a good job, I guess. But anyway, he said, but we are good with 8. And then it went on to talk about another provision to spend an extra $1 billion building a Navy destroyer that the Defense Department did not request money to build. Again, purely because of jobs in congressional districts. So you have the Marines that Mr. Flurry spoke about on Tuesday saying, you know, we need more money, we can't function effectively, we don't have enough planes, this is really hurting us. And then meanwhile you have the Coast Guard saying, well, if you're buying us another ship, I guess we have to accept it, but I'm not really sure what we're going to do with it. Now, to make things even worse, there's good evidence now that when defense companies design things like aircraft and these complicated systems, they're not looking to make the best planes they can. Instead, they're designing their planes to create jobs in key congressional districts. And this has been going on for years. Franklin C. Spinney, he is an expert on this area. He wrote a paper back in 1990 that's much referenced on this subject. And this is the summary of his paper back from 1990. It's really prophetic. The power politics practiced by the Pentagon and Congress continue to drag our nation deeper into a quagmire of spiraling weapons costs, shrinking forces, and high defense budgets. This essay describes how bureaucratic gaming and political log-rolling weaken our military, corrupt behavior in the Pentagon, and subvert the checks and balances of the Constitution. Left unchecked, these politics guarantee that the much smaller post-Cold War military will require a Cold War budget to keep it running. And that's what we see today, a smaller military that requires a huge budget. He goes on to talk about how the needs of a coherent defense policy have been preempted by the selfish desires of its individual components. He talks about how the real needs of the military are sacrificed on the altar of pork barrel politics. And one of the things he talks about is political engineering, and he describes that as the strategy of spreading dollars, jobs, and profits to as many important congressional districts as possible. By making voters dependent on government money flows, the political engineers put the squeeze on Congress to support the front-loaded programs once its true costs become apparent. And he writes, by designing overly complex weapons, then spreading subcontracts, jobs, and profits all over the country, the political engineers in the Defense Department deliberately magnify the power of these forces to punish Congress should it subsequently try to reduce defense spending by terminating major procurement programs. And this is exactly what we see with the F-35. It has all of these problems, but the vast majority of that $1.5 trillion, and it could well be more, investment that America is going to make in this hasn't been made yet. It's not too late for the military to change its mind, to cancel it, and to look at something else. But that's almost certainly not going to happen, because Lockheed Martin claimed that it would affect 125,000 jobs in 46 states. Now, it is quite late in the day to look at cancelling the F-35. There may be credible and good arguments that say that the US should simply stick with it and make the best of a bad job. But that argument and that discussion should be made, or that should revolve around the ability of this plane to defend the United States, not about which jobs will be lost in which congressional districts. And Spinney talks about how this whole process incentivizes the construction of overly complicated weapons. Because when you have a high-tech complicated system, then you can get lots of different contractors involved, which then adds a whole nother layer of problems. And you can spread that around the country more easily. And I've spoken and written about the huge vulnerabilities in the F-35 because it's so dependent upon these computer systems. And you look at all the concerns that have been around about cyber warfare for years, and you think, you know, this is crazy. Why did the US do this? But this could go a good way to answering that question. Having complicated computer systems allowed the planners, the manufacturers, to create jobs in more key congressional districts. And this is where you can quite clearly see the danger of this issue of military waste. It's far more than the billions spent on empty roads or crumbling hospitals in Afghanistan. You know, it's about a rot in the heart of the US military. This waste leads to ships we don't need, but the same factors behind that waste could also be fatally undermining things like the F-35 program, literally the future of America's air power. You know, there's the potential here of hundreds of billions, if not a trillion or more, to be wasted. I don't have time to get into it too much, but a lot of these problems reminded me of some of the problems that I'd looked into a while ago at NASA. They have this same jobs-first approach. And we don't have time to play them, but I did have a couple of clips lined up from people like ex-deputy NASA administrators talking about how this jobs-first approach is killing NASA. You know, because it's become a jobs program, not a space exploration program. And it's the same with the military. Defense manufacturing is becoming increasingly about jobs and not defense. And now, if you look at NASA, there are private companies that are doing the same thing that NASA are doing, in some cases around a tenth of the cost. And that gives you an idea of the amount of waste then that could be going on at the Defense Department, another even bigger government bureaucracy that deals with a lot of the same defense companies. What if the F-35 could have been built, you know, maybe not at a tenth, but let's just say half the cost? That would have been a trillion saved. That's a pretty huge amount of money. So what is happening to our nations here, to Britain, to America? We used to be able to produce great cutting-edge technology at good prices for the military. And now we've gotten to the point of all of this waste. Well, God blessed our nations, and now those blessings are being taken away. We're being cursed. You know, these blessings and these cursings, what God says will happen to our nation, they're listed in Leviticus 26. And one of those curses listed there is that our strength will be spent in vain. And we see that quite literally in this case. Millions, billions, maybe even trillions spent on worthless and useless projects. There's still strength there. You know, a huge amount of money spent on defense, but it's spent in vain. Just before this verse, it talks about our nations no longer having pride in their power. You know, there's still power there, but we're too timid to use it. And here's what Mr. Armstrong wrote back in 1976 in a co-worker letter on this passage. He wrote, "The United States has now won its last war, like we talked about at the beginning. We are defeated humiliatingly in South Vietnam by little North Vietnam. We have the power, but we're afraid to use it. Our high standards of living is starting downward. Our defeat in South Vietnam and the Watergate scandal, followed by the CIA scandal, have greatly weakened the respect other nations have for us. And we see that again with things like the NSA spying scandal, with American intervention in the Middle East, with all these other things we speak about on this program." And then he writes, "Europeans had relied on the United States for protection against Russia. They are fast losing confidence in that reliance. Soon they will unite politically and militarily in a gigantic United States of Europe, a resurrection of the once powerful Holy Roman Empire. And it will be a threat that could destroy the United States and Britain. Already the once proud British Empire has crumbled. They were proud of their power, a proud people, but they are no longer a major nation." So Britain, so America, we were once blessed in this regard. There were so many amazing stories when you look at both of our history of just amazing innovations, of inventions. We were blessed with some incredibly talented people. And instead, now all that strength is being spent in vain. And then the other part of this is the rot that this wrong-headed expenditure exposes. And this, when I was in my teens, I went through this phase where I wanted to start a tech company, and I read a lot of my dad's books on tech companies. And these stories from America's Defense Department, they sound like the kind of stories you get from these big, bloated companies that's about to hit a dramatic fall. It's hard to avoid the impression that the US is IBM or Oracle, that used to absolutely dominate the IT market, while somewhere out there, in some other country, there is Bill Gates tinkering in his garage and inventing the future with far fewer resources. You know, these stories, these that we've looked at, this is what a decaying empire looks like. And they also reminded me of some stories my grandfather would tell me about his time in the transportation part of the army after World War II, serving in Africa, before the British Empire really started to fall apart. And he talked about, for example, how petrol was being really severely rationed back at home. But in Egypt, they had so much of it that they were washing their trucks in petrol. They didn't know what to do with it. It made the trucks look nice and shiny. It was great at getting the dirt off, because they just kept sending them the same amount of petrol after the war as they were sending them during the war. And you had the same kind of mismanagement. You know, he also talked about when the army was pulling out of Palestine, as the whole region was called then, and about all the transportational resources and costs that were needed just to get the general's furniture out of there. It's not hard to imagine some of these things that we've talked about today, reading about them in a history book that's talking about the causes of the fall of America. You know, it's a sign that the military has become inward focused, that it's no longer the cutting edge force that it once was. I really don't have time to talk about it, but this is what the fall of an empire looks like. This kind of corruption, this kind of selfish spending, military spending focused not on defense, but job creation. And what we've focused on today, they're mostly just clear-cut examples of wastage. We didn't even look at things like $360 million spent on weight loss programs for family members of servicemen, for example. Things that aren't straight-up waste, but that Russia and China won't be including in their defense budget, but the US is. We can't deny so much of America's strength is spent in vain. And the result is a military force that looks amazingly powerful, absolutely overwhelming on paper, but that's all outward appearance. Inside, it's much, much weaker than it looks. That's the sobering truth about America's military today. Why was America blessed? Why are we now cursed? What does this weakness mean for America's future? If you haven't already read it, write for our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Now, that's about all for today. Brent Nachtigall is here already at Edstone. He's come in from Israel. He's going to be broadcasting live tomorrow, so make sure you stick around and tune in for that. Thanks for listening to KPCG here on 101.3 or at kpcg.fm. And tune in next time for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.